From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the science, the ethics, and the controversy surrounding embryonic stem cell research. We talk with Gareth Cook, science reporter for the Boston Globe. Last week, he won a Pulitzer Prize for explanatory journalism for his year-long series of stories about stem cell issues. Also, we talk about breast cancer therapies with Musa Mayer. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1989, and ever since completing treatment, she's worked as an advocate for women with breast cancer. She's written two guidebooks and a memoir, and has served as a patient consultant to the FDA's Cancer Drug Development Program. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Pulitzer Prize for Explanatory Journalism was awarded last week to Gareth Cook for his year-long series on embryonic stem cell research. Cook is a science reporter for the Boston Globe. The Pulitzer judges praised him for explaining with clarity and humanity the complex scientific and ethical dimensions of stem cell research. I asked Cook if when he started the series, he thought there were facets of the stem cell story that weren't being adequately covered.
The first story I did that really gave me a sense that something important was happening that we were missing was a story I did about a family deciding what to do with leftover embryos. It was a Catholic couple, and they had frozen embryos from infertility treatment. And they were faced with the decision of whether to discard these embryos or donate them for research at Harvard. And in talking to them, it just became very clear that how they thought of these embryos was very different from how it was being talked about by politicians on both sides.
How are they thinking of the embryos?
Well, when you listen to the political debate, you hear opponents of it talk about these embryos as little babies, and you hear people who support this research dismissing them as just a ball of cells. But for them, these embryos were their children. They had two children from these frozen embryos. So it was sort of ridiculous to think of them as just a ball of cells. But by the same token, they knew that they were not the same as having a child in front of them because it had been so difficult for them to have babies. So that just sort of introduced me to the gray and fascinating middle ground in this debate, which is we don't really have a good word for what these things are, but it's also clear that the way they're being talked about and these sort of caricatures are not accurate.
What did this couple decide to do?
Well, after it was interesting in talking to them, they had to decide whether or not they wanted to have more children because they felt the idea of just throwing these things away was just not acceptable to them because they'd been through fertility treatment, and that is a very difficult experience, and it felt like throwing them away would have been a waste, in a sense, a waste of the effort. So they had to decide whether or not to have children. They decided they really just didn't need more children, so they decided to donate them to Harvard in the end. But it was a difficult decision for them. They're Catholic. They support George Bush. They support his policies. And so they got a lot of pressure, I think, from all sides.
Maybe I should ask you the most basic question of all here, which is, what is a stem cell and why is it so important to researchers?
A stem cell is just a cell in the body that has the ability to do two things. One, it can replicate itself, and two, it can make more specialized cells. If you just think of your skin, for example, your skin is constantly replenishing itself, and that's with stem cells. The reason why scientists are so interested in this is because they want to tap this potential to regenerate tissues that have been damaged by disease. So if we could figure out how to use stem cells to repair the heart or repair the brain, we might be able to cure all kinds of diseases. Recently, it's become controversial because scientists in 1998 discovered a new type of stem cell called an embryonic stem cell. And this is a stem cell which has the ability to become any type of tissue. They can become any type of cell in the body, but at the same time, the only way to get embryonic stem cells is by destroying human embryos. And if you believe that life begins at conception, then this is the equivalent of taking a human life just to do research.
Well, in terms of the embryos that are being used for stem cell research, most of those embryos are coming from in vitro fertilization clinics.
Right. So a lot of these embryos that we're talking about that are used to make human embryonic stem cells would be destroyed anyway. So you have to ask yourself this question. Well, if they're going to be destroyed anyway, then why not use them for research? However, if you think these really are lives, then you have to ask yourself the question, why are we doing in vitro fertilization if the inevitable result is taking lives?
Well, but that's an interesting question that you pose. Do the people who oppose stem cell research oppose in vitro fertilization? Take the U.S. Catholic Conference of Churches. Do they oppose in vitro fertilization?
Well, the Catholic Church does oppose in vitro fertilization. However, a lot of the politicians who oppose this do not oppose in vitro fertilization. And I can't imagine that that would be a very popular political position if you just see how many children have been born and how much it means to so many families. So it's interesting because you can sort of, this is exactly the point where you can see the religious and ethical concerns and the political concerns diverging. And you can sort of see people coming up with these positions, which from an ethical standpoint seem somewhat tortured.
Let's look at where we are legally with stem cell research. You know, President Bush made his policy statement in August of 2001. And explain what his decision was.
He was asked to decide what the federal government can spend money on. And this has become a very contentious debate just because there's a debate over whether or not these embryos are human lives. It's been all caught up in the debate over abortion as well. So he was under a lot of pressure on the one hand from people who oppose this type of research, and from the other hand, groups of patients who want to see cures for these diseases. So in August 2001, he announced that basically human embryonic stem cells that had already been made could receive funding. So if you're a scientist and you want to work with human embryonic stem cells, you can do it as long as those stem cells were created before August 2001. But you can't make new lines of human embryonic stem cells. And at the time, I think it was sort of seen as a fairly reasonable compromise.
Now, what are the scientific limitations of using only stem cell lines from before August 2001?
One of them is that if you're a scientist working in this field, you don't get to derive new lines. And that in and of itself is important because you don't learn the process of doing it. And a lot of science is like gardening. You just have to do it in order to understand how it works. So not being able to derive these new lines is difficult. Another limitation is that the newer lines are in a lot of ways easier to work with because this is a fairly new technology. The first human embryonic stem cell was only discovered in 1998. With every year, scientists get better at making them and they become more easier to use. Scientists who use federal funding then are stuck with lines that aren't as good. Another limitation is that newer lines are being made that allow you to study specific diseases, and those would all be off limits.
Since federal funding can only be used for research on stem cell lines that were developed before the president's policy statement in August of 2001, there's a lot of research that scientists want to do that they can't use federal funding for. So there's a lot of initiatives to try to raise private funding for it. One of the places that has raised some private money is Harvard. And would you describe the institute that has been created at Harvard for stem cell research and what its goals are?
So the Harvard Stem Cell Institute was announced last year, and their goal is to raise private money to do research in a lot of different areas of stem cells. They're not just doing embryonic stem cell research. This project is driven by the conviction that stem cell research is very important, and if the federal government isn't funding it, then Harvard's going to go ahead and raise private money and do it.
Now, you describe this lab as being unmarked and in a location that is being kept secret. Why all the secrecy surrounding the location?
Well, the Harvard Stem Cell Institute is doing a lot of different things. There's one particular lab run by Doug Melton in which they're doing human embryonic stem cell work. The secrecy is because they don't want to be bothered. I think they're afraid that people who oppose this research might disturb them. They aren't that much more specific, but I think that they're concerned that revealing where it is could cause them problems.
In the same way that there are always demonstrators around abortion clinics?
Right, exactly.
So what is this lab focusing on in terms of the research?
Well, Doug Melton's lab is really driven by a desire to cure juvenile diabetes. He has two children with juvenile diabetes, which is a very difficult disease. And so he is basically trying to figure out what causes juvenile diabetes and what might be done to cure it. That said, his lab is involved in a lot of basic areas of research that will be useful to a lot of different people. One of the things he did last year is announce that he'd created a large number of new human embryonic stem cell lines and made them available for free to researchers around the country and around the world. That allows researchers to do all kinds of research. He's been in the news lately, though, because he's interested in doing what's sometimes called research cloning or therapeutic cloning. And that has been a very contentious issue here in Massachusetts and around the country.
What is therapeutic cloning?
Therapeutic cloning is, and I should say I don't really like the term therapeutic cloning. In therapeutic cloning, what you try to do is create a line of embryonic stem cells that have the exact DNA of a patient. This allows you to study their disease. For example, if you have someone with juvenile diabetes and you want to understand what causes juvenile diabetes and how you might cure it, you can create a line of embryonic stem cells that has the exact DNA of that patient.
So it's called therapeutic or scientific cloning because it's not reproductive cloning. It's not like the goal is to create a clone of a human being. It's just to clone certain cells for therapeutic use.
Exactly. And that's that's one of the many confusions in this debate, which is when you hear cloning, I think a lot of people think of science fiction. They think of babies in jars and all sorts of wild scenarios. What they're really just trying to do, though, is they're trying to create copies of the cells.
My guest is Gareth Cook of the Boston Globe. Last week, he won the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory journalism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Gareth Cook is my guest. He's a science reporter for the Boston Globe, and last week he won a Pulitzer Prize for explanatory journalism for his year-long series of articles on stem cell research. You point out how stem cell research is creating some interesting and unusual opponents. Like, for example, around the Harvard issue, you've got the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation supporting Harvard stem cell research. You've got the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops opposing it. You wouldn't think necessarily that the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation and the Catholic bishops would be at odds over anything, but they are over this issue.
Yes, I think that one of the things that's really driving this whole debate is the hope that stem cell research can cure a wide range of diseases, including juvenile diabetes. And this is why so many advocates for patients have been so involved in this debate. One of the stories I did, actually, is about the dangers of this. I did a story about a kid with muscular dystrophy, and his parents had heard all of the hype about what this research might produce. And I think that when you have the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation and these other advocates pushing for the research, it's a very difficult situation because there's a lot of people out there who, yes, could be helped by this, but also who might hear what they want to hear. And in this case, I did a story about this, about these parents who ended up going to the Ukraine to this clinic, which was offering stem cell therapy, which I don't think is really helping anyone, long before the science is really there. So you have, it's a very difficult debate because right now it's hard to know how many people are actually going to be helped by this. It's just basic scientific research. Scientists think it's very promising, but it's hard to know whether or not it's actually going to turn into medicine.
Yeah, well, you mentioned this this stem cell clinic in the Ukraine. You went there and interviewed the lead doctor there. What were your impressions of the clinic?
One of the most striking things that happened to me last year was pulling up to this clinic, and it literally looked like it had been abandoned. It was overgrown. It was rusted out. And I pulled up to this door, and me and my translator got out, and the door sort of opened up, and this gurney came out that looked like it was from the 1950s, and there was this thin white sheet over this dead body as they wheeled it out. It was this gruesome and strange scene. And then you get up to the clinic on the seventh floor, and it's as if you're in a completely different place. It's all shiny and paintings on the wall and rugs hanging from the walls and flowers everywhere. And talking to this man was it was a very strange experience because he, after all the reporting I'd done, it was fairly clear to me that he wasn't helping anyone. At the same time, I left with a very strong impression that he believed in what he was doing. And I have not been able to settle that in my own mind. I can't sort of figure that out, but I guess that's just one of the mysteries of human nature.
So how much money did the couple who you interviewed pay to go to this clinic and bring their son who had muscular dystrophy?
They've paid tens of thousands of dollars. It's really heartbreaking.
And what were the results?
Well, they say he's a little bit better, but not in any sort of dramatic way. You have to understand, though, the situation these parents are in, and I sat with them many times, many afternoons, and sitting there, you realize they are seeing their son literally fall apart in front of them. And when they go to doctors, doctors tell them there's not much they can do for them. And I think, in a way, the worst possible thing is to do nothing. And that's one of the things I was trying to convey in this article. And I have a son, so I think I understand where they're coming from, which is there's nothing so bad as the feeling as a parent that you can't do anything to help your child. So you'll try anything. And even if you think there's a 99% chance it's going to be of no use, just the mere act of doing something is doing something. And I think that that has helped them a lot.
As we've been talking about, you know, stem cell research is very controversial ethically. And one way around the major controversy being that embryonic stem cells are used, and to some people that is almost the equivalent of abortion. It's ending human life. They see the embryo as human life. One way around it is to use adult stem cells. That's what President Bush supports. That's what the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops support. So what about the science of adult stem cells? Is there any evidence that adult stem cells would accomplish what embryonic stem cells can?
Well, that is a very good question and also a very complicated question. I think that one of the fascinating things that happened in this whole debate is these political questions have twisted the scientific debate. And I think if you were to put aside the political debate and ask any scientist about adult stem cells, they would say, yes, they're very interesting, yes, they're very promising, and yes, they might lead to medicine. However, when you have this political debate over it, I think scientists who support embryonic stem cell research have become a little more reluctant to talk about the promise of adult stem cells because they feel like that is an argument that's being used against them. When you hear people talk about adult stem cells, one thing to keep in mind is that bone marrow transplants are adult stem cells. That's how they work. And every day, here in Boston and in a lot of other cities around the country, people are being saved with adult stem cells. The main difference that you need to understand between adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells is that adult stem cells typically can only become a few types of cells, whereas embryonic stem cells have the ability to turn into virtually any cell in the body. That's why there's been so much scientific excitement about embryonic stem cells.
There's a bioethicist at Stanford, William Hurlbut, who's also on the President's Bioethics Commission, who's proposed research for a type of stem cell research that he thinks would not require the use of new embryos and would therefore solve the ethical objections. It would answer the ethical objections. Would you describe what this proposed research is?
Sure. This is a very interesting proposal, and I think the idea is to try to find a technical solution to the ethical problem. What he's proposing doing is taking the DNA from a skin cell and placing it into an egg and then making genetic modifications so that that egg is incapable of becoming an embryo, yet is still capable of producing embryonic stem cells. Whether or not this would be successful depends on a lot of things. First of all, whether or not opponents of the research can agree on what is and what is not an embryo. You would think scientists might agree on the definition of an embryo, but it's actually not something that everyone agrees on. So that's one thing. The other thing is that technically this could be quite difficult to do. However, it's very interesting, and I devoted a story to it, because it's part of this general quest to perhaps find ways out of the problem that we're in right now. Maybe there are other technical ways of doing this type of research that don't raise these ethical questions.
Are scientists concerned that if a lot of time is spent researching this proposed form of stem cell work, that it will be taking energy away from actually doing more directly therapeutic-related research?
Exactly, Tara. I mean, that's exactly how this is playing out politically, which is that in their public statements, at least, a lot of embryonic stem cell researchers have opposed this and raised a lot of objections to it. They're afraid that basically we're going to see a repeat of what's happened with adult stem cells, which is something which, at least theoretically, has promised being used as an excuse to not pursue the research they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are restrictions on federal funding for stem cell research here, and that has made it difficult for a lot of institutions and scientists to do the research that they'd like to. There are a lot of other countries that don't have those restrictions. What's happening? What's the state of the art in other countries that are doing stem cell research?
Well, one trip I made was to the Czech Republic, and I was with a group of scientists there that are working on embryonic stem cells. They were delighted because Harvard and the other leading U.S. institutions dominate research around the world, and for them, the restrictions are really an opportunity. So what I did in that story is I went to the Czech Republic, and I also did a survey of countries around the world to find how many of them are now pouring into this area of research. And it's really quite stunning. The United Kingdom, Sweden, Israel, all over the world, you see labs pouring into this. You see massive amounts of money going into this area of research just because it is so promising.
There's a lot of people with diseases or people who have loved ones who have diseases that are really hoping that stem cell research is successful and finds ways of reversing diseases that are now incurable. And they perceive the lack of funding as one of the obstacles standing in the way. But how far are we, do you think, from, and I know this is an unanswerable question, but from talking to a lot of scientists, like, what are some of the guesses, like, under the best of circumstances for the researchers, how far do they think they might be from the kind of breakthrough that could lead to cures?
Terry, I'm really glad you brought this up, because this is a question that I think a lot of people misunderstand. This is scientific research, and it's very promising, but nobody knows if or when it's going to lead to actual cures. I think that if you were to talk to scientists in some of these fields, they would say that this is something that could yield amazing things, and yet we just really don't know when it's going to lead to cures. And I often get phone calls from people after my article saying, you know, my aunt has such and such disease, or I have a son with this disease. Can stem cell research help? And what I always tell them is, we just don't know. I know it's not a very satisfying answer, but that's what science is all about. It's about going into these areas where we just don't know. And if we knew, then we would already have a cure.
Well, Gareth Cook, congratulations on the Pulitzer, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Gareth Cook is a science reporter for the Boston Globe. Last week, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Explanatory Journalism for his series on embryonic stem cell research. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel, Night and Day, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Jeep, introducing the trail-rated Jeep Liberty CRD with next-generation diesel technology, emissions and performance capabilities at jeep.com.
Coming up, how treatment for breast cancer has changed in the past 25 years. We talk with Musa Mayer. She was diagnosed with the disease in 1989, and ever since completing treatment has worked as an advocate for women with breast cancer. She's written two guidebooks and one memoir about the disease. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Unless we die in a sudden accident, crime, or act of war, most of us will face a serious illness at some point in our lives. We will have to cope somehow with a shorter or longer period of physical diminishment, pain, and uncertainty, writes Musa Mayer. Mayer was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1989, and ever since finishing her treatment, she's worked as an advocate for breast cancer patients. She's served as a patient consultant to the Food and Drug Administration's Cancer Drug Development Program, and has led many workshops for people with life-threatening illnesses, their families, and caregivers. She's also written a memoir about breast cancer, as well as two guidebooks, After Breast Cancer and Advanced Breast Cancer, A Guide to Living with Metastatic Disease. Her first book, published just before her diagnosis, was a memoir about her late father, the artist Philip Guston. Would you describe what your surgery and therapy were after you were diagnosed with breast cancer in 1989?
I was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer, a pretty large tumor, and fortunately had no lymph nodes involved. In other words, the cancer had not yet begun to spread to other parts of my body. I chose to have a mastectomy, and I had implant reconstruction. And I had what was at that time a reasonably aggressive form of chemotherapy. I had 12 cycles of CMF, that's Cytoxan, Methotrexate, and 5-FU.
So you had for what at the time was a very aggressive form of treatment, the mastectomy and the relatively high-dose chemo. How does that compare with what you think you would have been prescribed if you were diagnosed with the same tumor today?
I think I would have been much more likely to have had a lumpectomy with radiation today. Although that choice was really mine. And I think that I would have been given Adriamycin and Cytoxan were I to be diagnosed today.
Are they?
And probably in a dose-dense form, in other words, every 2 weeks with growth factor support, which helps the bone marrow to recover between treatments.
So would it have been easier for you to recover from the actual treatments if you were going through it today?
Oh, absolutely. What's really changed most significantly since then is the support. There are much better drugs to deal with some of the side effects like nausea and vomiting than there were at the time that I was treated. I was really more frightened of the chemo at the time than I was of the cancer itself.
Well, that's probably true of a lot of women. And as you point out in the book, in the short term, it's the treatment for breast cancer that's much more debilitating than the cancer itself in the short term.
That's how many women feel. And in fact, for most women, they will never actually have a symptom related to the cancer itself, apart from perhaps feeling it in their breast or seeing it on a mammogram. They will never experience pain or any other symptom. The difficulties that they may experience, and as I said, they're much less now than they were, really have to do with the toxicities of the treatment.
Can you say with confidence, having done all the research that you have and having lived through it yourself, can you say with confidence to someone who is just diagnosed with breast cancer, the chemotherapy is difficult to endure, but it works much of the time. It is worth doing this.
Well, we are learning that it's not quite that simple, that it really depends on what kind of cancer you have. Breast cancer is a diverse disease. As far as we know, there are at least 5 different kinds of breast cancers. When you look at the genetic structure of the cancer itself, and not all of them respond to chemotherapy. In fact, for the majority of women with small tumors who are diagnosed at stage 1 or early stage 2, hormonal treatment offers much more advantage for her.
What's hormonal treatment?
Well, I say hormonal because we are in a time of transition. Hormonal treatment used to be tamoxifen. This was the drug that was offered to women routinely at the time that I was diagnosed. It's an older drug, and it actually prevents the estrogen receptors on the surface of the cancer cell from taking in estrogen in the body. So it can be used for women who are premenopausal and postmenopausal. Since I was diagnosed in the 90s, we've seen the approval of 3 drugs which are called aromatase inhibitors, and they work by actually, in postmenopausal women for whom the ovaries are no longer a source of estrogen, these drugs work by preventing the conversion of androgens, that is male hormones, in the body and in the breast into estrogen by inhibiting an enzyme called aromatase, hence they're called aromatase inhibitors. And these have been shown to be more effective than tamoxifen. And so they are now, as of just this last year, recommended as hormonal treatment for postmenopausal women with estrogen receptor or progesterone receptor positive breast cancers.
Well, getting back to what you were saying there were a couple of types of cancer that respond best to these estrogen inhibitors, these hormonal inhibitors. What about the other forms of cancer? How confident are doctors now that chemo works?
Well, at the time that I was diagnosed, it wasn't really certain if chemo cured patients or if it simply delayed recurrence. But today we know that a certain percent of patients will actually be cured. And there are some very, by having chemo, and there are some very good research on this and some good tools online that can help doctors and patients actually predict the benefit of chemotherapy. And there is a new test that actually is a genomic test, which looks at the about 16 genes in a woman's tumor and can, on that basis, predict whether or not she will have a recurrence down the line at about 10 years. And there is some indication, there's some pretty good research coming out, though it hasn't been yet confirmed, that this test can actually help to predict whether or not her tumor will respond to chemotherapy in addition to hormonal treatment. It's only available for women with early breast cancers that are node negative, in other words, the cancer hasn't begun to spread to the lymph nodes, and whose tumors are estrogen receptor positive. But one thing that is clear, and is the reason I mentioned this genomic test, is that we're probably treating 3/4 of the women who are diagnosed with early breast cancer unnecessarily. In other words, they are really cured by their surgery and radiation. It's just that we haven't known who actually needs the so-called adjuvant chemotherapy.
But you think that we're getting closer to being able to figure out who needs it and who doesn't?
Absolutely. I think we're going to see big progress in that area, in the area of individualizing therapy for primary breast cancer, and hopefully for women with advanced breast cancers too, actually being able to predict response to given drugs.
My guest is Musa Mayer. She's the author of a memoir about breast cancer and 2 guidebooks about the disease. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Musa Mayer. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1989, and ever since completing treatment has worked as an advocate for women with breast cancer. She's the author of a memoir and 2 guidebooks about the disease. When you were diagnosed with breast cancer back in 1989, you were faced with choices. And as you say in your memoir about breast cancer, choice should be empowering, but it wasn't empowering, at least not initially, to be given these choices. It was baffling, it was frightening, it was kind of paralyzing. What was the problem?
Well, the problem is that you're being asked to decide on something without, at a time of great emotional stress, that is when you're newly diagnosed with a disease, without having all the necessary information. This is what women face every day with a new diagnosis. And choices are only empowering when you have the time to learn and reflect and consider the implications of the choices you're making. Now we know that it's perfectly safe in almost all cases to wait for a couple of weeks to really get a number of second opinions, to study what is known about the various treatment options, and to take your time and choose carefully. To decide, for example, on what kind of chemotherapy or whether or not you'll have chemotherapy at the same time that you're trying to make a decision about breast reconstruction, for example, should you elect mastectomy, that's a little overwhelming. That's a lot to be thinking about at the same time.
Speaking of breast reconstruction, you had that done, didn't you?
I did. I had an implant, a breast implant. Implant surgery can be satisfactory for me, though I have to say, had I known what it felt like to have an implant, I think that I would have been less likely to choose it.
Why?
I think, it's a stranger in my body. You know, it's a part of my body that it has no sensation to me. And it never really occurred to me that I could be flat and be, since I had this option offered to me by the surgeon who did my biopsy, who said I can work alongside with a great plastic surgeon and help me make an appointment with him. And I just really didn't seriously consider going without. And that's the disadvantage, if you will, of having an immediate reconstruction. I think it helped me psychologically to feel that I was having something put there, although it doesn't replace what is taken away. But I'm not sure I would make the same choice again. I think these days the majority of women in most situations really can have lumpectomy with radiation. So they're not really facing that reconstruction decision for the most part. And, you know, I have many friends who've had bilateral mastectomies and happily go flat, altogether flat. And, you know, of course they wish they had kept their breasts, but that's certainly another alternative that never occurred to me at the time.
You were in a breast cancer group after your surgery and chemo. This is a group for women who, like you, had treated breast cancer. Did that help you, do you think?
I think it did help me a great deal. And in fact, I'm still very close to the women in that group. We still meet every couple of months, and we don't talk much about breast cancer anymore, although even all these years later, one of the members of our group has just had another primary breast cancer, so has just gone through another whole set of surgery and chemotherapy and so on. So in a way, it's always with us. But the group has always been very important to me, and that still sustains me and motivates my work today.
Years ago, earlier in the history of this group of women who had breast cancer and were treated for it, a couple of the women in the group, their cancer metastasized.
Yes.
And you write in one of your books about how this kind of created this uncomfortable, unspoken barrier between the women who were hoping that the breast cancer was really behind them and those for whom it had metastasized. Can you describe that gap, like what that meant to the women in the group?
Well, it's the gap falls both ways. It's hard for the women who live in fear of recurrence but have not experienced it to hear what it's like for the women who have had a recurrence. And it's also hard for the women who are living with metastatic disease to feel like, to feel comfortable sharing their stories, because they're very aware of how frightening their experience is for women with primary breast cancer. I've been in groups that are mixed, that is both early and metastatic breast cancers, and I've been in groups that are segregated, shall we say, where just metastatic breast cancer patients share with one another about their disease. And I see that they are much freer in talking about what it's really like when they don't have to be concerned for their sisters who have not had that experience. It's very natural for women to, when they're in a group like this together, to compare themselves with one another. So if you have a recurrence, and we've been seeing each other all the time for the last few years, and we feel like sisters in this experience, then that's going to make me worry about, even more about, gee, maybe I'll be having a recurrence too. It's just very scary and threatening.
Since you work with so many women who have metastatic breast cancer and who are facing not only their own mortality, but a lot of discomfort and pain and weakness and depression. I'm wondering about what you've seen women do to give their lives a sense of meaning and to come to peace with the sense of the brevity of life. You know, so many people turn to religion or find that their faith is deepened when they're really facing their own mortality. But not everyone has faith, or not everyone finds faith, even when facing mortality, even in the face of pain. For those women who don't have and haven't found faith, what are some of the things that you've seen them turn to?
It's very common for the women that I'm in touch with to go on disability so that they can spend more time with their families, more time doing the things that are important to them. Making memories is a theme that comes up over and over again, that they want to focus on sharing experiences with the people they care most about. And they find a deep sense of meaning in that and a sense of legacy. But I want to say that the majority of women with metastatic breast cancer that I'm in touch with are actually doing very well physically. They may even still be working full-time and living lives that, to the outside observer, would seem very normal. This is, I think, the perception is often that having metastatic cancer of any kind is sort of an immediate death sentence. But in breast cancer, for many women, not for all, but for many women, there are years of very good quality life. There are years of being on hormonal treatments that keep the cancer stabilized, where they can do anything and everything that that normal women do. They ski, they travel, they work full time, they take care of their families. And yet they live with this sense of stigma because other people find their situation so fear-inducing.
My guest is Musa Mayer. She's the author of a memoir about breast cancer and two guidebooks about the disease. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Musa Mayer. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1989, and ever since completing treatment has worked as an advocate for women with breast cancer. She's the author of a memoir and two guidebooks about the disease. You know, I know somebody who had breast cancer, and I think didn't talk about it a lot when she had it, but after she felt it was behind her, she was very proud of having gotten through it. You know, would refer to herself as proudly as a survivor. She ended up taking her life several years later as a result of depression. And, you know, I thought about her a lot reading your books and just thought a lot about how our sense of life and the meaning of life sometimes has less to do with the disease that we're facing than just the things that wire us for mood.
It's true. I mean, I suppose that's one reason why I feel it's been so important for me. I wouldn't prescribe this for anyone else, but to go and really explore some of the darker places, because I think they're there anyway. Most women who go through a breast cancer experience touch some pretty scary, dark places in themselves. And if in their lives they haven't confronted their mortality before, the opportunity is there. And it can be a time of sort of deep personal reflection. I want to say that this can be a benefit and that many women end up feeling in some way, in some strange way, grateful for having been through that. And perhaps the unacknowledged dark parts can emerge as depression. Sometimes depression is a biochemical disorder that may be untreated. I don't know. I can't comment on what your friend went through, but I embraced the experience. You know, I used my diagnosis and my recovery and my contact with other women with breast cancer as a way of opening up to my life. And I'm not suggesting that everybody diagnosed with breast cancer do that by any means. But it's one of those times in your life when you really do have an opportunity to stop and figure out what means something to you and what you want to do with the rest of your life, however long that may be.
I want to read the opening paragraph of your book, Examining Myself, which is your memoir about having breast cancer. This is a paragraph about insomnia. You write, "Every restless night contains a point beyond which the notion of sleep becomes a charade and ceases to be a real possibility. Yet how hard to surrender, to admit defeat. Better to lie there grimly, hour after hour, accruing the insomniac's nightly investment in futility, the countless shifts of position, the repeated untangling of bedclothes and punching of pillows, all the long, intricate trains of thought leading nowhere." A beautiful description of insomnia. You talked before about the importance of, like, really thinking about the dark things, which is typically what a lot of people think about when they're in bed, unable to sleep. Do you still have insomnia? It's been years since you wrote that memoir.
Actually, I rarely lose a night's sleep anymore. I'm happy to say. I guess I've become a lot more resilient in that way. But at that time, not knowing what lay ahead of me and trying frantically to master breast cancer as if it were a sort of academic course, and feeling so out of control, I think my mind was just laboring to somehow understand or comprehend on some level what had happened to me. I was sleeping again pretty regularly within a month or so of that time that I wrote about. And the process of writing, for a long time I was doing writing workshops for breast cancer survivors because the actual process of writing my way through that experience had been so important to my recovery. that I became persuaded that that would that could help others too.
How did it help?
Just giving words to experience that is overwhelming. Just being able to distance oneself a bit from that those momentous changes in one's life, and to put to make a narrative out of it. I think human beings are natural storytellers to themselves and to others, and there's something about the very process of making a story out of it. I discovered that when I was working on the memoir that I wrote about my father and about growing up. And I eventually was able to apply that to breast cancer and to help other people do that too. And in my experiences online, in various internet communities where people tell their stories, I saw that and I see that today happening constantly, that people are able to find a measure of equilibrium and distance from the overwhelming events of their lives through writing.
Well, Musa Mayer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Musa Mayer's books include Advanced Breast Cancer and After Breast Cancer. You can find more information at her website, www.advancedbc.org. That's www.advancedbc.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, Creating a Legacy of Physical and Emotional Health by Dr. Christiane Northrup. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times foreign affairs columnist Tom Friedman. His new book, The World is Flat, is about how outsourcing and the global economy have changed our lives and the world. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.